Welcome to the Bill Barnwell Show. I'm Bill Barnwell, ESPN. I'm here. It's Monday, September 25th, 2017. We are going to talk about week three of the NFL season. And joining me to do that, frequent guest on this show and other podcasts, perhaps, at ESPN, Mr. Will Brinson of CBS. Will, how are you?
Bill, what's going on, man? Thanks for having me back, not shutting me out after my tryst.
Your tryst with Field Yates, the best hair in podcasting, that duo right there for sure. We have a lot to get to. It was a really exciting, fun week. I have to admit, I was someone who was a little skeptical of the quality of play complaints after 2 weeks, and I think anyone can say this week wasn't a fantastic set of games in terms of quality of play, in terms of the offense, and certainly got some fascinating finishes, and the biggest of which is a game that we're not going to get to at length. Maybe we'll cover it later on Nickel Package, perhaps, but a game that had a very fascinating ending, the Atlanta-Detroit game, which ended with the Lions winning and then seemingly losing.
Yeah, wasn't that something? I mean, the pass that looked like it was completed to Golden Tate in the end zone, he's ruled down at the half-yard line, mm-hmm. but there's 8 seconds left. You know, there's a 10-second runoff, a rule that I think Dean Blandino said has been actually in place since, like, 1950.
Really?
Yeah, I think so, but now it's going to be called – that can't be right. I feel like it was, like, put in 10 years ago, but, you know, this rule has been around for – at least a decade is suddenly going to be the Golden Tate rule. And now the Lions are going to all have the Calvin Johnson rule and the Golden Tate rule. And Lions fans feel perhaps appropriately upset at the way it played out. I think, though, that the officials, it's like a lot of these catches, Bill, the officials got it right in the sense of getting the rule right. But it also feels like it ran counterintuitive to how we want competition in football to exist, in that the game ends on a play that is not a play, in a 10-second runoff. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing I thought that was interesting is when they did the review, and I tweeted this out, but they didn't run the clock back to when Tate would have been stopped if he mm-hmm. was down. And so there's 8 seconds left, but it looked like there probably could have been 11 seconds left, and certainly the Lions could have run a play with 1 second on the play clock and snapped it quickly. Or you could even argue that, you know, with 8 seconds left, they could sprint up there and get something off. I don't know. It feels a little dirty, but I do understand that it is sort of the right thing.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, realistically, I do think there's some fairness to the rule. I think it would be perhaps unfair. I think if you were a Lions fan and the rules were reversed and, you know, the Falcons got a free clock stoppage and then got to run a play on fourth down to win the game, I think Lions fans would be saying that was an unfair rule. I can't imagine they would be, you know, just taking the side of, oh, well, the rulebook says that, I guess we're just, oh, well. You know, there's a realistic argument to be made with the rule there. So I hate that it turned out that way, but I don't think the rule is inherently unfair. Let me ask you, do you think with that 8 second, with that 8 second mark or 9 second mark, do you think the Lions really would have been able to, had they been stopped, had the clock been continuing to run, would they have been able to run an actual tangible play over those 9 seconds?
The Lions, I will say, I will give a 50-50 chance to. If it were the Chargers, I would say 10% chance they could do it.
It's too early to be sad about the Chargers in this podcast, Will.
I know, I'm sorry. the Chargers bandwagon is like a one-wheeled bus lying 100 yards down in a crevasse. I mean, it's just a disaster of a bandwagon.
The
Lions did tweet out a play where they're like, look, we did this exact same thing. I think if he had been ruled, if they'd said no touchdown, the Lions had no time. The Lions couldn't challenge, right? I don't know. I guess you couldn't challenge, so you just sprint up and try and run a play. I think they probably could have gotten it off, but it would have been very, very close. And that's why I sort of side in the idea that this rule is fair, in that, you know, you can't just assume that they would get to the line fast enough to snap the ball and get the playoff. And I think it probably would have taken close to 10 seconds. You know, you're moving quickly. You're down in the end zone. It didn't seem like a bunch of bodies were laying everywhere, though. And I feel like Matthew Stafford operates pretty well in those circumstances. Mm-hmm. So maybe 30-70 they get it off. Maybe, I don't know. It just stinks that the game ends on a clock runoff. And, mm-hmm. I give him a little bit of credit for maybe pulling it off.
Yeah, it's possible. I think I was a little too negative on it when I wrote my column. Just like reading it back, the thing I would say is this: like, if you're going to run a play on fourth down, you have to have called a play previously. You know, when you're sending in the third down call for that pick play, I don't know that Jim Bob Cooter sent in a play for fourth down, because there's no way you can line everyone up and like signal for something that you're going to run and also get the snap off, have everyone lined up and run a successful play. I find that very hard to believe. Now, could they have run a sneak on fourth and one? Yeah, I buy that. Everything would have had to go right, but I would say Matthew Stafford is really good on sneaks historically. I looked it up. He's 20 for 22. With a yard to go on third on a third and fourth down, looking for a touchdown, you know, or a first down.
You probably never heard about this, but you know, he's kind of got a big body, like a catcher, sort of like he big physical guy. Mm-hmm. I don't know if he was Clayton Kershaw's catcher. A lot of people don't know that. Jimmy Graham also played basketball.
Were they friends?
Yeah, they were friends.
Like, were they cool? Did they enjoy each other's company?
they did. I could actually see something too where Stafford sprints up there and just runs a sprint right and hopes for Golden Tate or Marvin Jones or somebody just to make a play, and that works out too. I think with that team, just the hectic way that they operate on in these late game situations, it feels like you could have trusted them to get something off. Mm-hmm. You know, as opposed to a lot of teams, I feel like a lot of teams would sort of freeze up and maybe just not even get the playoffs off altogether.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I do trust the Lions offense more than most, so I think it is feasible. But yeah, we have a lot to get to. I agree with your sentiment on it. One thing I will say, as someone who did grow up as a Giants fan, is I have a lot of faith in other teams pulling things off that the Giants may not be able to pull off. And I have seen some brutal losses with the Giants, of course, some victories recently, but hard to think of many worse games if you're a Giants fan than the game which ended with a 61-yard field goal being hit by the Eagles to come away with what might have been a season-crushing defeat for the Giants. Let me start with this, Will. Do you think this loss, the way the Giants lost this game in the final few seconds, was this better or worse? Was it more painful or less painful than the DeSean Jackson punt return touchdown game against the Giants a few years ago?
Oh God, I would say way less painful. That game, I mean, this is a dagger, but it was, you know, you can make the case that you can make a couple of cases here that the Giants should have won this game or should have had an opportunity to win this game earlier than they did. You can also make that the Giants did so many dumb things from a play calling perspective and an execution perspective that they shouldn't have even been in the game with an opportunity to lose late. DeSean Jackson, I just remember. I mean, like I don't know. I don't. I remember. I'll remember where I was watching 61-yard field goal, but mainly because it was yesterday. I will never forget watching that punt return and just being like, oh. And I said the walk-off punt return is probably the worst way to lose.
Really?
And I think so, because you're thinking, okay, just kick it and get like. You know, you're kicking and play some defense. like, just don't let this guy score from that far away. Mm-hmm. I've seen Giovanni Bernard had a near walk-off punt return against NC State a few years ago. That was probably one of the most soul-crushing losses ever. The worst State was an underdog by 7.5 points. So you're like, well, at least if you have something invested on the side on this, you're not going to get burnt. And then Carolina fumbled the extra point.
Oh, no.
Scored on the 2-point conversion.
Oh, no.
Yeah, that's awful. This is a bad loss, but I still think I would say the punt return loss is worse. And I mean, there were a lot of missed opportunities for the Giants in this game. And you know what we were talking yesterday over DM about like what we were watching. My response was, I'm watching Ben McAdoo call a sweep to Orleans Darkwell on a third and one early game for the Giants.
Yeah. It just seems like, you know, for a team that has so many veterans, for a team that has such a sort of locked in infrastructure, sort of, you know, this is not a new playbook. It's not a new play caller. It's not mostly not new personnel besides Brandon Marshall. And Evan Engram, like the you should kind of know what you're doing at this point. It's a surprise that the Giants seem. It's almost like they will play terribly in a game on offense, and then the week will pass, and then they forget about what happened, and they get to the next game, and they're like, oh, wait, we can't pass protect, or we can't run the ball, we can't block, like forget about everything bad that happened up to that point. I mean, there was a point in this game where the Giants had, like, something like 8 carries for 7 yards on offense, or something ridiculous like that. I mean, it was an ugly performance, but then it felt like they were going to, despite themselves to an extent, pull it out, given how great Odell Beckham was for a stretch of time, given that they got a fortuitous turnover when Zach Ertz fumbled, and they really were able to take advantage of a bunch of injuries on the Eagles' defense.
Yeah, and the thing is that, you know, Odell Beckham had those two tremendous catches in the end zone. Mm-hmm. They probably got hosed on a touchdown catch by Sterling Shepard that, you know, to end the first half, and then they couldn't punch it from the half inch. I think he actually said the half inch line. We're placing the ball on the half inch line, not even half yard line, half inch line, and they couldn't score from there. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a devastating blow. You go for it on the fourth down, and again, you run Orleans Darkwell up the middle against one of the best defensive lines of football when you have one of the best wide receivers. I don't know. It feels like a misuse of personnel. You know, they had opportunities though, because the Eagles kept playing this soft coverage outside mm-hmm. like on. They could have run those slants to Beckham all day long. Like, just throw a slant to Beckham over and over again and hope he jailbreaks one. And it just felt like they didn't. I wonder about this McAdoo thing and the play calling stuff, if he is failing to see the forest because he's in the woods, you know, because he's so deep trying to manage the game and trying to run the play calls that he's not sort of seeing the larger stuff that's opening up that somebody else might see mm-hmm. if they were play calls. And I don't know. It feels like the Giants offense is probably not going to be good. I mean, they can't pass protect, but if they can, you know, they started out the game running that quick up tempo type of offense and mm-hmm. it worked a little bit for them. I think they just borderline have to abandon the run and just dink and dunk a lot and hope that Eli Manning is on for full quarters.
Yeah. I don't think that's, you know, really all that unfair. And the Eagles were running that sort of really conservative scheme because their secondary was so beat up. I mean, Rodney McLeod was out. Corey Graham was out. Jalen Watkins was out. Ronald Darby was out. They lost someone else during the game. In their front seven, they lost Jordan Hicks, who's an every down linebacker for them and a coverage linebacker for them during the game. And of course, they lost Fletcher Cox, who is one of the best defensive players in all of football, in the second quarter. So by the second half, I mean, they were down to bare bones on defense. So I think they really didn't have a lot of faith in their defense to hold up against the Giants passing attack. And we're sort of hoping that they could limit those shorter throws and close on the football and tackle. And you saw what happened. I mean, there was that, the long touchdown pass to Sterling Shepard was a play where the Eagles had their third string safety, Chris Berrigos, back as the center fielder. And he took a terrible angle. He took out Patrick Robinson as he was pursuing, and it was off to the races. I mean, it kind of felt like this was a game plan where the Giants really needed to put their playmakers in space and give them the ball and hope that they were going to be able to take advantage of a Eagles secondary that was, really flimsy at best. But that was not the game plan at all, it felt like, for chunks of the contest.
Yeah, and I mean, that's the thing, is that I think people who were watching the game sort of saw that, right? Mm-hmm. They saw how it was unfolding, and they saw that if you could just, you know, run these quick plays and let Eli get off a pass, and you're right, the Shepard thing, he just got it in space and he took off, and they had better matchups. I mean, you should have utilized Odell Beckham like that. I mean, he should have come away that game with 22 targets and 17 catches, even if being short, just hope he jailbreaks one. Mm-hmm. And if you jailbreak two of those, you're going to force the Eagles to play come from behind. And the Eagles themselves are kind of limited offensively. You know, I thought like LeGarrette Blount ran pretty well. His best game ever, not as a Patriot, maybe.
Since college, for sure.
Non-Boise edition. Carson Wentz missed a wide open pass to Alshon Jeffery down on the left side that should have been a touchdown. Wentz, by the way, that guy, he just picks up a couple first downs with his feet.
He's so mobile. I mean, he is. He's probably been the best, I would say, running quarterback in football so far this season.
That's probably right. Assuming, yeah, I mean, even Russell Wilson has run more, but he not as effectively.
He's running for his life.
He really is. He's near death every time. It felt like this was a game where the Eagles are sort of shorthanded. They're playing a team that doesn't match up necessarily. You know, that matches up well with them from a defensive point. You know, like the Eagles knew they needed to scratch and claw and get X number of points, and they eventually did it. But yeah, this is a game. The Giants, desperate at 0-2, you know, with those shorthanded defensive situations for the Eagles, they needed to pull it out, and they just didn't. And this NFC East is wide open, I guess, and these teams go up and down a lot throughout the season. But it's just hard to imagine the Giants making any sort of run. It feels like the people are, well, it's been 10 years since that miraculous run. You know, it's like that doesn't mean anything. You know, that was a very different team.
Yeah, that was just Eli and 52 other guys at this point. I mean, you know, it kind of felt like, okay, well, even though they're not a good football team, even though they had their issues, they were making that run in the second half. They were able to piece enough good things together that they were going to pull this game out. And then you figure, okay, well, if they pull this one game out, maybe it'll get better as the season goes on. Maybe they will, you know, make a couple changes. Maybe we'll, you know, maybe you'll see the Giants sort of like, they'll have McAdoo not call plays, or the defense will get healthier. Things like that will happen. And then they made a bunch of mistakes that you would associate with a rookie team, with the Browns. They made Browns-esque mistakes over the final couple minutes of this game. They had a long pass interference on Eli Apple, on Torrey Smith, the king of pass interference, to set up an Eagles score. They had a drive that was very promising, that was into the red zone, but that was called back for a illegal shift, which I think Eric Flowers was penalized for it, but I don't want to blame him necessarily. I think it was just the team wasn't set. And then Flowers had a terrible hold that pushed... Oh, sorry, these are two separate drives, excuse me. But the illegal shift took away a play, and then the hold put the Giants in second and long as they were driving for what would have been a game-winning field goal. And then had a check down to Shane Vereen where, you know, with 50 seconds left, he goes out of bounds, saves the Eagles a timeout. I mean, just stuff where it's like, you guys know better than this. Like, this is just, it was such sloppy, it was sloppy play from a team that you would hope would be a veteran team at this point, which wouldn't be making these sort of mistakes. I mean, there's no way the Eagles should have gotten the ball back to have a chance to kick a 61-yard field goal. I mean, so yes, it's incredibly unlucky to see a 61-yard field goal go through the uprights to cost you a game, but they set themselves up for failure. You think about the DeSean Jackson game, you know, they didn't have to punt the ball in the middle of the field, and they did. They set themselves up for probably the worst possible outcome, and then that's exactly what happened.
It's unforced errors. And, you know, in golf, you talk about course management, you know, and not, like, don't do something that is unnecessary that is later going to burn you. Mm-hmm. And that's what, you know, like, when Elliott buries this 61-yard field goal, it's because you gave him an extra 10 seconds, you know, by going out of bounds. I mean, Shane Vereen played for the Patriots for years. Like, you're supposed to – Bill Belichick would have cut him yesterday if he had gone out of bounds on that play that cost the Patriots a game. And, yeah, it just feels like – and I don't think Tom Coughlin's teams were always perfectly coached and perfectly disciplined, but I do think that this Giants team – and this Giants roster lacks that organization and that discipline that you would often see with those Coughlin teams. And of course, Coughlin's the guy who, you know, let the DeSean Jackson punt happen.
Yes. Well, I mean, he reacted to it in a way that was not exactly thrilled about letting the DeSean Jackson punt happen, from what I can remember.
Oh, sorry, was it Brad Wing then too? Did he?
No, it was Matt Dodge was the guy's name.
Yeah. Because he's from ECU. He's from East Carolina. That's right.
He was pretty much cut. I think he was cut, like, while DeSean Jackson was returning the punt. I think Tom Coughlin was actually filing the paperwork.
He's lucky. He's alive.
It's very fair. It's very fair. Tom Coughlin. I don't want to say Tom Coughlin has killed a man, but I feel like he at least there's danger there to be had, for sure.
You know what is remarkable, by the way? So I didn't realize this until literally last week, but Tom Coughlin never served a day in the military or in the armed forces. And I'm not knocking him, but I just assumed he had like a 15 to 20 year distinguished military career.
It does seem like it would fit.
Yeah, he didn't serve, never served a day because he was playing football. Isn't that odd?
It is strange. Yeah, I would have, if you had asked me to guess, I would have guessed as well that Tom Coughlin was a veteran. So the Giants, I mean, it's not looking good. 4.3% chance of making the playoffs now that they've started 0-3. I think they were about 37% before the season. We do have Giants Chargers coming up in 2 weeks, which is a real, real sadness bowl for October. But do you, I mean, is there any way back for them? Like, do you think that 4.3% chance is fair? Do you think it's higher or lower perhaps than what's listed there?
No, I think that's right. Or, you know, close enough. Again, that division is odd, and we have seen, you know, we have seen some weird things happen in that division. It is hard when you look at the schedule for the Giants, though. They're at the Buccaneers, who lost this week, but should be looking to bounce back and present a pretty good matchup for, you know, Tampa Bay in that respect. Then they get the Chargers, who will probably be thrilled to be out of Los Angeles and that in the away home game. Broncos on the road on Sunday Night Football. That won't be easy against that defensive front with that offensive line. Seahawks, again, not easy, even though it's an East Coast game. Rams are going to create problems. Aaron Donald will be a mess for them. Yeah. 49ers in San Francisco. I mean, look, 49ers probably aren't good, but their defensive line is not a problem. Then the Chiefs, Redskins, Raiders, Cowboys, Eagles, Cardinals, Redskins. I mean, that's a tough stretch when you're 0-3 right now.
It's a tough stretch, and it's a stretch that's really built around a lot of teams that have great pass rushers or great front sevens, which if only there was a way to figure out who you were going to play before the season and spend your offseason acting accordingly. Who could have known?
Right. Incredible. Like, you can't know that you're going to have – you don't know who your offensive line is going to be months before the season starts. I mean, it's not like you have a list of players – sorted by position out there and knowledge of who's on your roster. It's just impossible.
No, it's like Pop Warner. Just see who shows up the first day of practice, and then if you get some good players, great. And if not, you'll make it work because you're the New York Giants. Do you buy the Eagles? I mean, 55.5% chance of winning the NFC East before the Monday Night Football game. A team that's 2-1, of course. They were beat by the Chiefs. Maybe the score doesn't reflect the actual game itself. I thought it was a very solid performance from them, and then wins over Washington and now over the Giants. Do you buy them as a favorite to win this division?
Yeah, I can see. I liked them. I mean, we both liked them to win the division before, so that maybe that makes it a little bit biased. But I certainly think that they are capable of taking the division. I would say that really hinges on two things. One, we have, I think, roughly 7 days to find out what will happen with Ezekiel Elliott. And, you know, if Zeke Elliott misses a ton of time, I could see the Cowboys losing some games and the Eagles maybe pulling away a little bit. And then the other two, I think, is that, you know, they played the Cowboys on, I would have said, look, the Redskins look great on Sunday night, and I don't want to count them out, but for the sake of this discussion, I think that the two games it really comes down to is Sunday, November 19th at Dallas. That's Sunday night game for the Eagles. And then the December 31st, the New Year's Eve day game at 1 o'clock at home in Philadelphia, that week 17 game that, you know, didn't matter last year, should have a whole lot of impact this season. And I think that you really need for the health of that defensive line. The Eagles have to have that defensive line stay healthy, because if it doesn't, there could be, you know, we talked about the secondary and how bad they were. If they lose that pass rush and that defensive front seven, you could really see that defense sort of fall apart, and that would be a major problem against the Cowboys.
Yeah. Do you know who the Eagles play this weekend?
The Chargers.
They're at the Chargers.
I would guess that that's going to be a very green game, because do people from Philadelphia move to Los Angeles? I feel like they might not do that, but I also feel like there's enough Eagles fans where there will be some just inherently in and around the Los Angeles area.
Is there going to be any game all season with the Chargers where they have more home fans than the opposition?
No. I mean, that Dolphins game felt like. And it stinks, too, because that was one of the biggest problems in San Diego, and it's just plaguing them in another city. And, you know, if you're Philip Rivers and company, it just makes it tough to go to work on Sundays knowing that, you know, you're going into your home stadium in sort of a new – I mean, it's sort of like switching – high schools and getting beat up on like the first day of class, or you know, like maybe not beat up, but just getting, you're walking to this new, I think you're walking to this new place, and it's like it's full of enemies. I mean,
it's very fair. I mean, they have Eagles, Broncos, Bills. Oh, they have the Browns at home on December 3rd in a rematch of last year's 0-15 game.
Yeah.
That's going to be very compelling. I don't know. Maybe that's their shot. I don't know. But, yeah, let's just move on from the Chargers. It makes me too sad to even discuss at any length. Let's talk about a team that did save their season on Sunday, unlike the Giants, unlike the Chargers, in the NFC South, the New Orleans Saints, who would have fallen 3.5 games behind the first-place Panthers with the tiebreaker, first-place Falcons as well, with the tiebreaker after starting 0-3. No one's ever won their division doing that, and the Saints were able to pull that off. A very nice game for them in Carolina, blew out the Panthers. And let me ask you, Will, given how bad this defense was through two games, what changed to help them win by 21 points in Carolina in week three?
I thought that Sean Payton, Bill, had a really, really good game in terms of offensive approach and offensive attack. The Saints, so they did a couple of things. One, first of all, the offensive line was fantastic. And I love the Panthers to beat them like a drum in Carolina. But what happened was the offensive line held up against Carolina's front four.
Yep.
And when you do that, you know, just like, you know, if, against any team, but especially against Carolina, you can sort of expose the secondary a little bit. And they really use screens and play action to sort of neutralize that pressure that Carolina was hoping to get. Mm-hmm. And they had a bunch of big screen plays. And then I thought that Payton also did, you know, they've been doing this thing where Adrian Peterson, whenever he was on the field, they were going to run.
Yeah.
Well, the first touchdown was a play action on first down to Adrian Peterson that ended up with a Brandon Coleman touchdown. And I think, you go back and watch it, and like the Panthers defenders are just following. You know, like, they're just biting on the play action because I think they're probably in tune with the idea that Peterson – on the field is a cue for a run. Yeah, I mean, it was and part of the problem for the Panthers was, once again, and this plagued them against the Bills, that they, you know, they couldn't do anything in the red zone. Mm-hmm. And they got the Saints scored early, and it got the Panthers out of their game plan. The Panthers, on their first drive, Bill, had 10 rushes, averaging 5.2 yards per carry, and they ended the day with 22 rushes.
I mean, some of that's game script. Like, if you're behind two scores, you're going to throw the ball. But I see absolutely what you're saying in terms of, you know, this is a game where even if the Saints got ahead by 7 or 10 points in the second quarter or the third quarter, like, you want the Panthers to still be running the football. It's still going to be the strength of their team. And, yeah, I mean, I was really fascinated by the Saints' game plan because it was a little different from what we saw over the first couple of weeks. You look at the snap totals. Adrian Peterson only played, I believe, 14 snaps. So behind Mark Ingram, who had 29, behind Alvin Kamara, who had 17, in a game where you'd figure if they were ever going to really give Adrian Peterson a big workload, it would be this game, where they're ahead in the fourth quarter, they want to close the clock, and he might play that Marshawn Lynch role for them, similar to what Lynch has been doing in Oakland over the first 2 weeks. But he didn't get a ton of snaps. Kobe Fleener only played 14 snaps. He was the third tight end in this game, really, in terms of workload. So, again, part of that was that they were leading in the fourth quarter. They didn't really need a receiving tight end in the fourth quarter, but really sort of leaving some guys on the bench and who were playing bigger roles certainly over the first 2 weeks of the season.
Yeah. By the way, I meant to ask this to the Eagles, but the Saints came up as a logical trade partner. But the Eagles, because it's Darren Sproles, you know, ACL and
for the arm.
Yeah, I mean, we assume out for the year. Would it make sense for the Eagles to trade for a running back? And if so, you know, I realize the workload usage doesn't match up with Mark Ingram, but Sean Payton seems to have some sort of disdain for Mark Ingram that he never really plays him. Why not call the Saints and say, what do you want for Mark Ingram?
Yeah, it's an interesting thing. I mean, the Eagles are a team that trades as much as anybody in football. So, you know, really not hard to believe they'd make a trade. I wonder if is he too similar to LeGarrette Blount for you, maybe?
I was thinking Adrian Peterson's too similar to LeGarrette Blount.
Also fair. I mean, Ingram's a better receiver than Blount is for sure, so you think he'd be more of a threat on first and second down. But yeah, I mean, it's an interesting question. I think that's hardly out of the question that the Eagles look at a trade. And certainly, I mean, there's too many backs to go around here, and Alvin Kamara's not going anywhere. Of course, they just drafted him, and he's been very useful in a limited role, and you figure his role is going to expand as the season goes on. But yeah, I mean, it does seem like there's something that's going to happen over the next few weeks, whether it's that they trade Ingram, whether it's that they cut Peterson or trade Peterson, which seems perhaps more plausible to me. It's not, unless they go on a winning streak and no one cares, it just seems like this is a recipe for serious unrest because it hasn't been working. And I do think they're a better offense with with Peterson and Camara than they are, or sorry, with Ingram and Camara than they are with Peterson in the lineup.
Yeah, it didn't. And it did, the reason why the Saints' addition of Peterson in the offseason never really made any sense was that, you know, you have to, the same reason it didn't make any sense when Peterson was playing with Sam Bradford in Minnesota. And that's not to say that Bradford is a better player over the course of his career than Peterson, but if you're going to be operating out of this, you know, shotgun offense and trying to wing the ball around, you don't really have a need for Adrian Peterson because you have to line up in power formations and run downhill with AP. And I don't know, it just doesn't fit with what you want to do with Drew Brees, at least to me. And you just kind of have to minimize AP depending on what the flow of the game is. And if he's not going to be the hammer when you're up 21 points on the road outdoors against a division rival, then what is he even doing on the roster? Because he's not there for like veteran leadership. They have that. It doesn't make a lot of sense. The defense for New Orleans was a lot better too. Although I think I probably pin a lot of that on either Cam Newton being inaccurate, and he was inaccurate. If you look at his three interceptions, one wasn't his fault.
It's a tip ball.
Two, he just blatantly locked onto an area of the field, and it was. But all three of them were in the short right, just short right passes, not out boundary, but just right there inside the hash marks. And I almost wonder if there's a sort of physical limitation in terms of what Cam's looking at because of his shoulder. I don't know. I mean, like I'm not a doctor, obviously, but you almost wonder if Cam's sort of still feeling it out, you know, trying to get his shoulder right. You can tell his timing is off with he's got all these new targets and his timing's off. He's not practicing during the week. That's a major problem for a guy who's trying to get in rhythm with a young guy like McCaffrey, you know, a guy like Funchess, who he has reps with, but not really that many reps.
Right.
Kelvin Benjamin, back, but now hurt. Greg Olsen out, and they have a play calling issue too. And I'm sure you and I have beat on Mike Shula plenty, and he had a great year in 2015, but he is just not being creative the way he was in 2015, or in utilizing the different personnel the way we thought he might when they drafted McCaffrey. And it just feels like once they got down, it's just Cam just gonna be check down Charlie to Christian McCaffrey, and the Saints started poaching on it and picked up two interceptions in that short area.
Yeah, I'm intrigued to wonder, and I probably have to watch GL22 for this. Is I wonder if those two interceptions were the two interceptions that were Cam's, that were, you know, Cam's fault. You might say were plays that just the Panthers have been using for years. I mean, the first one, the PJ Williams pick, he was reading it from the moment the ball was snapped. Like, it was looked like an RPO with just a slant route and a flat route, and he was reading the slant the entire way. Like, it wasn't even he felt more confident about that pass going to that spot than I felt about anything in my entire life. And got it. And then the third pick was Kenny Vaccaro, where, again, he's playing. It looked like they were showing a cover. They were showing a cover two look, and he was actually more of a robber and moved into more of a cover one robber look. And Cam didn't seem like Cam recognized that. He had a receiver wide open on a crossing right head in the other way, but Vaccaro again was closing on the ball from before Cam even threw it. So I wonder if this is stuff where, given that the Saints are not exactly the most intuitive or intelligent team on defense most of the time, and make pretty, you know, elementary mistakes, I wonder if this is a thing where just the Panthers are running stuff that, you know, and maybe in part because Newton isn't practicing and doesn't have the chance to really run new things, if they're just running stuff that they've had on tape for years, and, you know, that a defense like the Saints that is blind most of the time can even pick up on it and make plays in advance.
No, I think you're spot on. And look, when Newton, on both of those plays, I mean, again, you have to watch the All-22 I don't even know that I need to watch the All-22 to tell you that he was locked in on his receiver.
He was, for sure.
He took the ball and he locked in on him. He didn't bother trying to, you know, move a safety or anything. He wasn't, you know, he was, in fact, the first one, the PJ Williams one, he gets it, and I think he just blindly throws it. And it was like a play action, sort of like one of those weird, you know, not a pure play action, but sort of like a weird draw play action. And then he comes over top and fires really quickly. I think it is something they run a bunch. And you've seen Cam. I think he just jumped the route. That goes back to a play calling thing, though, because you know you have a quarterback who's limited in terms of what he is able to do on the practice field. And you know you have a division opponent that plays you twice a year, that, mm-hmm. you know, with the same coaching staff that's been around for almost, you know, a decade against, you know, against Mike Shula. I mean, you got to be a little bit more creative there.
Yeah, for sure. And I don't know what you do at this point, because clearly Cam isn't 100%. And I'm not saying he's a bad player. I think he's been fine for stretches. And, you know, I think Cam, when healthy, is a fantastic football player, but he's clearly not 100% right now. And you can't really do much about it, because the next, their schedule, I mean, it gets really tough from this point forward. This was supposed to be a game where if they got enough to a 3-0 start, they'd feel a lot better about themselves, because right now, in the next few weeks, they have four road games in 5 weeks. They're at New England, at Detroit, which looks pretty tough, hosting Philadelphia, which looks like one of the better teams in the league. They're at Chicago, and I don't, you know, the Bears had looked awful in week two. They've been pretty scary at home in week one and week three. They've been a very solid home team. And then they're at Tampa. They host Atlanta after that, and then they have Miami before their bye. I think this is a team that they might really benefit from having a week five bye, and it's kind of a bummer they don't have a bye until week 11.
Yeah, and I think the other underrated factor here, too, is the absence of Ryan Khalil. And I think he makes a big difference for Cam, because, you know, look, I mean, Cam's a great football player, but having that veteran center, really underrated player who's had a tremendous career, able to sort of call out the protections and to help you, you know, get set before the snap. Like you saw on the third down play on the Panthers' first drive, Cam, and you can hear the announcers talking about it, Cam's calling out Kenny Vaccaro as, you know, for whatever reason, and pointing him out. Matt Khalil completely misses Cameron Jordan. I mean, completely misses him. He just gets in the backfield. Cam sacked. And Cam, by the way, his accuracy dipped pretty quick after that hit. You wonder, you know, how much is – if a guy with a bad, you know, surgically repaired shoulder, how are these hits affecting him? He's taken a bunch in the last 2 weeks, excuse me. And, you know, I think having Ryan Khalil out there has made a big difference in how the offense looked week one versus weeks two and three by a long shot. And, you know, when he got hurt last year, everything fell off a cliff too. So I wonder, you know, how quickly can they get him back, especially against, you know, a Matt Patricia defense on the road, and then you have the, you know, Terrell Austin's defense has been playing pretty well for the Lions.
Yeah.
That Eagles front seven is going to be a major problem without Ryan Khalil there, and the Bears have. Yeah, this is like you said, it's a tough stretch, but it's also a sneaky tough defensive stretch.
Yeah, for sure. And I don't know what you do. I think that, you know, they brought Cam back, and maybe they rushed him back because he's not the guy who won MVP in 2015. He's inconsistent at best right now, and that has to be frustrating if you're a Panthers fan. We have to get to a break. We're going to come back with more Bill Barnwell Show here in a second. But first, guys, I've got some interesting facts for you here from the folks at Gillette. Did you know the tip of a Gillette razor blade is measured on an atomic scale? It means their blade edges are thinner than a single brain cell. And that precision, well, that's the work of many brain cells. The hundreds of members of Gillette's research and development team have spent over 4,700 years combined, working to make your shave closer and more comfortable. That's longer than the Egyptian pyramids have been around. And while over 1,000 craftsmen and women in Boston are busy making your blades, another team is putting your blades through more than 60 extremely strict and precise quality checks. Fail just one of these tests, and it does not leave the factory. In other words, the hardworking people at Gillette never stop working to make your blades better. And now, that includes the price tag, because you can get Gillette blades at their lowest prices in years. See for yourself at GilletteOnDemand.com. Gillette, the best a man can get. Pricing applies to select products and is at the sole discretion of the retailer. All right, welcome back to the Bill Barnwell Show. I'm Bill Barnwell of ESPN, joined here by Will Brinson of CBS. We have two more games to get to here as we recap week three of the NFL season. Let's start with a team again. We talked about the Saints, a team that were able to revitalize their season. The Giants were not able to do it. The Bengals tried. They tried real hard, but they could not hold on and ended up losing to the Packers. I guess it didn't work out too poorly because everyone else in the AFC North lost, so they're not in quite as bad shape as it might seem, but has to be frustrating for the Bengals to put together a really good half of football, show a lot of things that they weren't showing in previous weeks, and then just not be able to hold on for that victory against the Packers and Lambeau.
They're technically behind the Browns in the standings, I think, if you sort by point differential. They're -7 and the Browns are -20. Yeah, look, this is a And you're right. I mean, everybody else in the division lost, so that's a big help. But the other two teams in the division are 2-1, and the Bengals could be 1-2, and right there, sort of getting back involved. The offense looked much better, I thought, with Bill Lazor running it, and you know, I mean, for whatever that's worth. I mean, it, you know, sometimes that's a dead cat bounce situation.
Right.
The defense, Carl Lawson was terrorizing Aaron Rodgers all day long, and I know that technically that these two timeouts didn't affect Pete Prisco on our Pick Six podcast last night. People can check out on iTunes. Yelled at me because he was pointing out that the two timeouts didn't matter. But Marvin Lewis used the timeout to ice the kicker, ice Mason Crosby on an extra point. Just incredible on so many levels. And then they used, before they even ran their first play in overtime, they also called a timeout. Now, again, Bill, those don't matter. But that says to me, you're unorganized and doing things the wrong way. If you're using, you're just misusing your timeouts all over the place, it tells me that you are not prepared to go into overtime and put together a drive that helps you win a big game on the road against the Green Bay Packers.
I mean, yeah, it just felt like they were holding on for dear life over the final few minutes of this game, and really for most of the second half, in terms of you know, sort of not they had opportunities to finish the game off, but it just felt like, you know, they were gonna, it was gonna take something really impressive from their pass rush, which really was what kind of got, you know, got them going for most of this game. And by the end of the fourth quarter, I mean, as good as they were for most of the contest, they were kind of out of gas, which isn't, that's true of a lot of pass rushers, I think, around the league. I mean, you see in the fourth quarter, you know, sack rates do go down, I believe, and hit rates go down. But yeah, I mean, it was rough for them, and they were so good for most of this game that I think even I see both sides of it. Like, I don't think the timeouts really played a significant difference, but it did feel like they just had such a lift in the tank. And realistically, I mean, this was a game where they could have sealed this with another first down. I don't think it would have won the game, but I think it would have made things a lot easier for them in terms of holding on. But they got sloppy. Andy Dalton, Joe Mixon fell down on a 3rd-and-1 carry on the 27-yard line of the Packers with 4:31 left. And then the Bengals decided to kick a field goal. They decided to kick a 46-yard field goal to make it 24-17 with 3:51 left on what amounted to a 4th-and-1.5. Would you have kicked that field goal, or would you have decided perhaps to go for it and try and hold on to the football as opposed to turning it over to Aaron Rodgers?
I think you make the argument both ways, and I think you can point to Bill O'Brien kicking the field goal in New England too, and it's it is easy for me to sit here with my feet propped up in the comfort of my above garage remodeled, like, would be mom's basement, and to say, yeah, you got to go for that, you big wuss, Marvin Lewis. It's tough in the situation to say to go for it, but you have to understand the situation that you're in. You're on the road in Green Bay, or, you know, in the case of Bill O'Brien, on the road in New England. You're against one of the 10, in either situation, you're against, like, one of the 10 greatest quarterbacks ever, and you're gonna just kick the field goal and say, I dare you to score 7 points on me in Lambeau. Aaron Rodgers, of course he's going to score. He's like, of course he's going to score on you. You know, everyone knows what's going to happen. And in both cases, it was you gave the ball back to him, and it stings that you gave the ball back to him. You know, you gave him the ball back to 7, and you say, all right, you know, tip your cap, you beat me. But he's going to beat you because that's what he does, and that's why Aaron Rodgers is who he is. And I think I'm not surprised that Marvin Lewis did it, but I would prefer my coach to be more aggressive in that situation and try to put the game away, to try and control your own destiny in that situation by running the, you know, picking up the first down, or being, you know, you have the weapons there. I would have gone for it, but I can understand the conservative nature, and I'm not surprised they didn't go for it.
I agree. I mean, I wasn't expecting them for a moment to go for it in terms of reality. I was thinking about it more as like a hypothetical, were I in charge. Of course, I was not in charge and will not be in charge anytime soon. I just, it's really tough for me to sit there. And it wasn't even like it was a gimme field goal. It was a 46-yarder, where if you miss that, you're in serious trouble. At least with a hit field goal, I guess you're going to overtime. But
And you're averaging, you've got 4 first downs on the drive. You're averaging over 5 yards per play on the drive. you know, just man, I don't want to say man up and get a yard, but I mean, man up and get a yard. Like, just, you know, like, I mean, you have a shot to, this is a season changing win, Bill. Mm-hmm. If the Bengals go into Green Bay and steal one from a banged up Packers team. And as soon as they didn't, when you're 0-2, you should be desperate. And when you're desperate, you push the envelope a little bit in terms of what you're willing to do. And I don't think that was the kicking the field goal was not the desperate move.
Yeah. I think that's fair. Obviously, the big play was the 73-yard completion to Geronimo Allison in overtime after the Bengals went 3-and-out very quickly. I have to wonder, if you're a defensive coordinator facing the Packers, how much do you have to beg your defensive lineman not to jump off sides?
I mean, I think your boy Scott Van Pelt said something on SportsCenter afterwards. It's like Aaron Rodgers leads the NFL in free plays since 2008. By like 75, like he's got like 75 of them, and the next closest is like 11. I mean, mm-hmm. he just gets guys off sides every time, and every time he makes them pay with a shot down the field. There's nobody better at. I mean, Tom Brady's probably close just because he's smart enough at it, but Rodgers mm-hmm. has that the combination of speed and lateral quickness when he's running, and the ability to get the throw off from any angle allows him to just devastate you when he gets you off sides, and he gets people off sides a lot. And yeah, I mean, like you're literally giving him a free play, and there's no consequences for whatever he tries. So of course he's going to try. It's the opposite of whatever Marvin Lewis would have done. You know, Marvin Lewis is like, oh, free play, let's run into the line. Of course, Aaron Rodgers devastates you.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder if it was a thing where. I remember with the Seahawks a couple of years ago, there was that they had a fourth down play that was a free play against the Packers, and they ended up just having everyone run over it after the penalty was called. Ended up being a touchdown pass, I believe, to Jermaine Kearse. So I wonder if this was a thing where it was the same kind of thing where the Packers look at the play. I mean, everyone goes downfield. It's a, you know, I don't know if they called. I don't think it was four verts, but it was definitely a couple go routes on the sidelines. I don't know if it was a play where they had a big, you know, a big play dialed up and. Or if it was a thing where, because of the penalty, everyone realized, okay, let's just run downfield and someone's going to get open. Because, I mean, it was a one false step from Georgia Loca, and that's all Aaron Rodgers needed. It was Geronimo Allison hitting up the sidelines, I think, against cover two, and there was just that one false step was enough. Loca maybe should have made the tackle, should have kept it to a 30-yard gain as opposed to a 72-yard gain. But, yeah, I mean, the Bengals were at points down there, both their starting safeties. Loca came back, but it was just a... they put themselves in a situation kind of like the Giants where they had the opportunity to be burned by Aaron Rodgers, and that's unsurprisingly exactly what happened.
And it was 3rd and 10 too. So you didn't, I mean, you want to get to him, but you don't need to jump off sides.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's not 3rd and 3. So you're not going to give him a free first down, but you know, be a little bit more cautious there. You know, just don't jump off sides, get some pressure on him. And I don't know. Maybe you're right. Maybe he had the deep play dialed up. But it felt like once they went off sides, I almost wonder if do you think the receivers know when that flag is thrown, mm-hmm. or do you think? I mean, I feel like that flag was thrown so quickly. Like the receivers. I was have dialed it up real quick. The receivers saw the guy jump off sides. Mm-hmm. So I almost wonder if they have a built-in hot route or. Built-in, you know, play where, like, if you see the guy jump off sides, get vertical.
Get going.
Yeah, and Aaron's going to chunk it up to you. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised at all if that was the case.
Yeah, I think that's what happened with the Seahawks on that play. I believe they didn't have, like, a downfield pass call. I think it was, like, fourth and seven. Maybe it was going to be 4th and 2. I don't remember the exact situation, but I do think they had a sort of a hot read where it was, okay, if you see this, get going and get downfield because we're going to try and get a big play. So it wouldn't surprise me. I don't know specifically. I didn't read any stories afterwards saying that was exactly the case with the Packers, but I do believe that is certainly not out of the realm of possibility, especially with Aaron Rodgers, where you're going to see that flag a couple times a game. Like I would be shocked if they didn't have that, you know, in their playbook.
Yeah, I mean, like, I paused it, and, like, all three wide receivers in the play are staring at the guy offside. And spot, ran the ball, and, like, two offensive linemen are pointing out, and Rodgers is snapping the ball. I was thinking it has to be built in, and that's
that's how you
consistently win a lot of football games, because you are using what you do well to take advantage of someone else's mistakes.
Yeah.
I mean, you're building in a situation to pick up chunk yardage and get free. I mean, you know, otherwise if it's an incompletion on that play or short of 10 yards, they're probably punting and maybe the Bengals win the game.
Yeah. Not out of the question. Injury is definitely a problem for the Packers, even though they did come back and win this game. And they were out. They were without Randall Cobb, Devon House, Nick Perry, David Bakhtiari, and Mike Daniels all throughout this entire game. And is there someone you think the Packers are missing more than anybody else?
I think the Mike Daniels thing is a. I mean, just maybe I'm overrating it because of how bad the Seahawks offensive line is, but I just think, you know, what he can do. I mean, to be a complete team, they are going to need that pass rush and that presence up front and that interior disruption. So, I guess I would say Daniels would be the answer. I will point out, because I would be remiss if I didn't, that my boy Josh Jones is going to be a heck of a football player.
Mm-hmm. 2 sacks.
Yeah, most sacks ever by a Packers a rookie defensive back in a single game. 11 total tackles, I think. He's like a modern DW, you know, defensive weapon. You can line him up in a bunch of different places, and he looks like could be a fun fit. I think he works in any defense, but certainly in that Capers defense as one of those guys that moves around a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. All right, well, you mentioned the Seahawks, and we'll get to them and their offensive line and their woes in a second. But first, I got to talk about Blue Apron. Blue Apron, of course, if you're familiar, if you're a podcast listener to pretty much any podcast, but if you're listening to this show, of course, Blue Apron is the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country. If you are someone who is perhaps subpar at cooking, I don't want to point any fingers, but I'm someone who is subpar at cooking, Blue Apron makes it easy and affordable for you to cook at home several times a week. Cooking together builds strong family bonds. Research shows that Blue Apron families cook more than 3 times as often. So if you have a family, it's easy for you to cook with your family and make things, make home-cooked meals for them. If you are someone who lives with a partner, you can cook Blue Apron for two. And it's so convenient. All the ingredients are laid out for you. They're all responsibly sourced and fresh. Blue Apron makes it about as easy as possible. I don't know how. Easy is the important word, because I hate cooking. I'm so anxious about it. And I cook a Blue Apron meal, it is a breeze. It's so cool to know, okay, I'm going to come home to an easy home-cooked meal that's going to taste great and be affordable. And what's cool is that Blue Apron, of course, doesn't make you have a particular kind of cuisine. If you have an allergy, if you have a preference, Blue Apron will allow you to select a different sort of menu, because they have so many different options every single week. And this week, or coming up next week on Blue Apron, I should say, sweet pepper chicken with Italian pasta and spinach, crispy buttermilk catfish with roasted delicata squash, spicy poblano and mushroom quesadillas with baby romaine and avocado salad. So many different options. That's only 3 of them. There's more coming and more different recipes every single week from Blue Apron. So, that sounds promising to you. Even better, you can go and get your first 3 meals free, with free shipping, $0.00, by going to blueapron.com/Barnwell. You'll love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron, so don't wait. blueapron.com/Barnwell. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. Seahawks Titans, a game that ended up looking close with the final score, but it did feel like the Titans really outplayed the Seahawks more than the 33-27 final score seemed to indicate.
Yeah, and I thought it was fascinating, Bill, to see, you know, I can't remember what the score at halftime was, but I think it was like 6-3 or so. I mean, it looked like maybe a low score.
It was 9-7.
9-7, yeah. And that was actually, there's sort of a flurry of points there at the end, because it was 0-0 after one. I went back and averaged up the yards per play on each possession for the Titans. I did it in a graph. I should have tweeted it out, but it's 3, 1.7, 0, 1, 4.1, 3.7, 2, 5.9, 17.5, 9.8, 75, and 7.3. And then, you know, those final two possessions, they were kind of basically clocking it out.
Right.
I think they just... This is what makes Tennessee really interesting to me as a long-term viable team to do some damage this year, is that they are not too dissimilar from the Cowboys and the Raiders in terms of they're so physical up front, maybe more so the Cowboys because the running game is their bread and butter, that they just wear you down. And you could see Seattle, as good as that defensive is, and they are loaded with talent on the defensive side of the ball, they just got worn down. And mm-hmm. Pam Oliver said before the game that, you know, Pete Carroll was worried that the humidity and the heat was going to be a factor in Nashville, the South, and it's sticky out there. But yeah, I mean, like they just wore down the Seahawks and eventually started popping off big plays. And I do kind of wonder if they passed a lot out of the gate. Mm-hmm. You know, they did one run, two passes on the first drive, two runs, one pass on the second drive, and zero runs, three passes on the third drive. Couldn't get anything going. I feel like that's sort of been a theme for them. I've been surprised by it a little bit.
Yeah, I think that's all really accurate. I do think this reminded me a lot of the Packers game for the Seahawks in Week 1, where the defense was it wasn't the same sort of game, and the pass rush really wasn't there. They actually didn't knock down Marcus Mariota on a pass play or once, didn't sack him once during the game. Of course, there was that hit in the sidelines, which we'll get to in a minute. But it wasn't like it was that sort of, you know, running around everywhere, dominant pass rush or anything, but the defense was playing pretty well for the first, you know, first half of the game and into perhaps the third quarter before, actually, not the last drive of the first half. And then, like you said, as the game went on, they did wear down. And that's going to keep happening to this team if the Seahawks can't do anything on offense. I think that if they can be a functional offense, yeah, the Seahawks defense is going to be able to hold up. But we've seen it now twice in 3 weeks, and that's kind of getting... It's becoming a trend. Like, it wasn't like they were great against the run against the Niners in Week 2 either, where they were getting tired in the second half. So I do wonder if the offense just has to do something to try and hold on to the ball in the first half. And I don't see that happening. I mean, they're not good running the football right now. And this was their best offensive performance of the season in terms of the offensive line, according to, you know, people who watch the Seahawks pretty closely. And it was still bad. I mean, there were still two plays in this game, at least in the fourth quarter, where the Titans rushed three against the Seahawks and got pressure within 2 seconds on Russell Wilson.
Yeah, and I think the problem is that you can, if you're a team looking at how to play the Seahawks, you don't worry about, and if you go back, you look at that last drive of the first half for Seattle, Tennessee, I think LeBeau sent blitzes on both of the big pass plays, and what happened was, you know, Russell picked him up, identified him, and pushed the ball downfield. And you just don't need to blitz this team. You send three guys or send four guys, drop everybody in coverage, make Russell, you know, read the field in a muddled pocket, and just ensure that you have guys who will be there. Don't, you know, you got to have some guys facing him. You don't want to, you know, have him playing man and running down the other side with their backs to Russell. But if you have guys facing him and don't let him break contain and take off down the field, and you force him to make plays inside the pocket with that offensive line, the Seahawks are going to struggle on offense. They are just, they can't protect and they can't run the ball, so they're sort of one dimensional. And you almost wonder. You know, I haven't finished reading it, but Andy Benoit had an article on SI.com pointing. Mm-hmm. Basically, the Seahawks need to redo their offense, and I think he's onto something. You know, they need to figure out a way. You know, you don't want to run some up tempo offense that gets that gets Russell Wilson and company off the field faster. But mm-hmm. I do think you need to figure out some way to change how people are attacking the Seahawks, and that may involve just, you know, reverting to something closer to what the Patriots do, which is don't worry about running it. You know, let Russell make these short passes and utilize these running backs, CJ Percy's out in space and, mm-hmm. and get the ball. All of them, they're not a good offense right now.
No, they're not. And I mean, I do think that the tempo thing would be a problem, but I do think that, you know, a little more zone read would probably be good. It's what they've turned to in years past when they've gained an offense, and it's worked pretty well for them. I think they want to avoid getting Russell killed, but I do think that given how bad the line has been, he's going to get killed one way or another, like you're saying. I mean, it really is brutal. On the flip side of the ball, I mean, what did you think of Richard Sherman's day in terms of his coverage and then in terms of that hit on the sidelines on Marcus Mariota? Do you think that was a dirty hit from Richard Sherman?
It was probably an aggressive hit, but I don't know that it was necessarily dirty. I don't want to ascribe intent to it, although it is a little bit easier to maybe sense some motivation for Sherman to try and... I think Richard Sherman is probably getting frustrated right now. And, you know, it'll be interesting because the Seahawks are 1-2. If the Cardinals win on Monday night. They're 2-1, and the mm-hmm. Rams are 2-1. This division is pretty wide open at this point, except outside of San Francisco, I think. And at what point does all the stuff that we heard about, all the narrative we heard about in the offseason about Sherman's, you know, disappointment with the offense and all of that, at what point does it boil to a head when the offense can't help them win games or can't even put them in the point to win games? And, you know, that Hill Mariota came after, not long after he picked up not one, not two, but three flags on a single play, which is one of the most impressive things I've ever seen. And are they getting frustrated? Is the lack of offense bothering them? Do they feel like they need to make plays and be more aggressive on defense in order to flip the field? And is that manifesting itself in a hard sideline hit on Marcus Mariota? I mean, that none of those things seem that unreasonable.
Yeah, and I don't want to take away anything from Tennessee. I don't want to make it out like the Seahawks blew this game or that they lost this game more than Tennessee won. I thought Tennessee was really impressive as the game went on. They really did a great job getting pressure on Russell Wilson, of course. But then, you know, their offense was great in the second half against one of the best defenses in football. And it wasn't just like, you know, chunk yardage down the field. It was big plays. I mean, the Rishard Matthews screen for a touchdown where the Titans had three offensive linemen out there versus two defenders, and Cam Chancellor just kind of got lost in space and wasn't able to close down Matthews at all. And then that really impressive 75-yard touchdown to DeMarco Murray where it was a bad angle from KJ Wright. They sealed off the edge with Richard Sherman cracking down and then had incredible blocking downfield. I mean, it's fair to say that there was better blocking downfield for those touchdowns than there were at the line of scrimmage for Russell Wilson on some plays.
Oh, yeah. No doubt about it. I mean, they were you know, you watching it this morning, you see the two on the initial cut to the left. I mean, there's two guys out there that create a hole for Murray. And by the way, his hamstring's just fine.
Yeah.
He made some beautiful cuts. He sort of looked like a, it's fun watching DeMarco Murray run because he's sort of like a, like an SUV, like weaving through traffic, right? You know, he's not blasting anybody, but he's, you know, I enjoy watching it because it is powerful. And then he gets down the field and there's three more guys down there blocking for him within in the red zone. You know, these guys are sprinting down the field and laying blocks. And the other touchdown to Jonnu Smith, I am fascinated by that touchdown because they line up Smith, who now has two touchdowns in two games, as a fullback for the first time this season. And they run play action to Derrick Henry with an end around coming around the backside. So you have to account for the play action to Henry. You have to account for the end around. And I think it was, Rashard Matthews, but I'm not sure. There's a wide receiver running a clear out route up on the top side. And so Jonnu just releases like he's just walks out like he's blocking and just gets a clean release and he is wide open. And I am consistently flummoxed at how impressed I am by Mike Mularkey's offense.
Yeah, I mean, it reminds me a lot of Shula in 2015, where it was, you know, teams were so concerned about the running game and so focused on what was happening in the backfield that, you know, there were passing plays to be had downfield just because linebackers were totally frozen. And that's the case with, that was the case in this game for sure in the second half, where you had guys who were just staring into the backfield, waiting to see what was going to happen and then trying to react, which is not, you know, that's not really what Seattle does best. They're a defense that can do so much in terms of attacking the line of scrimmage. So, yeah, I thought a really impressive performance from the Titans, and I don't know. I think that division's really interesting now in terms of what we're seeing. Houston really showed up and gave an impressive performance against the Patriots. The Jags were incredible in London in the morning, blew out the Ravens, and now we have Tennessee looking like a really talented team. So maybe something to be hopeful for in the AFC South.
The Colts won as a home underdog to the Browns.
Yeah.
Anyway, I picked the Colts in that game. I'm a loser for picking the Colts. Like, you have an opportunity to fade the Browns as a road chalk, and I picked the Browns. Excuse me, not the Colts. I mean, like, what on earth is the matter with me?
I wanted to believe. I'll leave it at that. I'm not as sad about the Browns as I am about the Chargers, but a lot of sadness to be had over the first few weeks of the NFL season. Well, thank you so much for coming on.
Yeah, thanks for having me as always, Bill. And
where can people check out more of what you're doing?
At Will Brinson on Twitter, CBSSports.com, and we got the Pick Six podcast as well, which people can check out on iTunes. Lots of screen. We do hot takes, and on Tuesdays I try to craft literally the hottest possible take, and then and then ask Pete Prisco or Jason LaConfora if it is accurate, and then they yell at me because they're like, this is the stupidest thing I've ever heard. I'm like, well, I told you it was a hot take. It's an overreaction. It's supposed to be stupid. That's the whole point.
Do you have yours ready for this week yet?
No. One will definitely be Jaguars related, because every week I can talk Pete into buying back into the Jaguars. I was like, the Jaguars can win the AFC South, and LaConfora crushed me. And then Pete's like, these are so ridiculous, but that one probably is true. He's like, Pete, what does it matter, Pete? The Chiefs are the best team in football. That's one I'll use, that's for sure.
Tremendous. I don't know that I disagree with that. That's awesome. Well, thank you so much. I'm sure we'll have you back on later on in the season to talk more NFL.
Absolutely, man.
All right, guys. Thanks so much for listening to today's episode of the Bill Barnwell Show. Be back later this week with Wednesday's episode of the Nickel Package and another Bill Barnwell Show previewing week 4. Pretty quarter way through the season or so. A little less than quarter, but you know what I mean. Coming later on this week. I believe on Friday we're going to drop that episode. So more Bill Barnwell Show, more Nickel Package, more audio coming to your ears later this week.